everyone who loves books. This is Read On.
I'm Juliet Stevenson, and you're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sail, and coming up this week, we announce the winner of the 2018 Costa Book Award and bring you the author's reaction. Juliet Stevenson shares her passion for narrating talking books and reveals the one that got away.
I had voices for all those characters. I was particularly proud of my Hagrid and my Dobby the elf. And so I was absolutely furious with Stephen Fry when he was chosen to record them.
Janice Galloway extols the virtues of short stories.
If you've got a set of headphones and you get on the train to go to work, you can listen to a whole short story without the annoyance of, I've arrived at my destination and I've just reached an exciting bit.
N.B. Dixon explores a medieval revolt through a hidden gem in the library. And Angus MacDonald introduces us to a tale of love and blindness in the First World War. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The annual Costa Book Awards recognise great writing across five categories: novel, first novel, biography, poetry, and children's books. The competition is open to authors living in Britain or Ireland and writing in English. The individual category winners then go head-to-head to compete for the title of Costa Book of the Year. The result was announced this week, and the winner of the 2018 Costa Book of the Year Award is The Cutout Girl by Bart Van Ess. It's the true story of the author's search to find out what happened to a young Jewish girl who was sheltered from the Nazis by his Dutch grandparents. The judges hailed it as a hidden gem that should be read by everybody. You can hear my interview with Bart about The Cutout Girl and winning the Costa Biography Award by downloading episode 103 of our Read On podcast. But now, here's Robert with Bart Van Ess's reaction to winning the 2018 Costa Book of the Year Award.
We heard Bart Van Ess on Read On last week, as you were a contender for the Costa Book of the Year. You've now won the Costa Book of the Year. How does that feel?
Oh, it is overwhelming. I feel very emotional about it, actually, particularly because Lean was there on the day to celebrate, and it just felt such a kind of perfect end to what's been this utterly emotionally exhausting and joyous process. So yeah, no, it's amazing.
Now, you talk about exhausting process. Have you stopped at all since Tuesday night?
Pretty much not. No, I came back late last night, having an amazing kind of round of interviews and just so much warmth in relation to the book. A couple of calls this morning as well from the Dutch papers. It's been great.
And it's all this attention for a book that had a very quiet release back in the summer.
It really did, yeah. I was slightly scared. I mean, I wasn't expecting the Costa Book of the Year, but I was hoping for a bit of attention, and it really barely got reviewed. So there were a couple of months of thinking, gosh, you know, you pour your soul into a book and it, you know, can disappear. And it shows you how important these prizes are. I mean, I'm immensely grateful to Costa.
And the prize was awarded just after Holocaust Memorial Day.
I think it is something that is very important to memorialise. So if it can do anything to kind of strengthen the importance of that date in people's minds, then all power to the book on that front.
Now, you mentioned you were doing some Dutch press. How has the book gone down in the Netherlands?
Well, really well. I mean, actually, the odd thing was, as you say, it was very quiet in the UK, whereas it was the opposite in the Netherlands. It was already out in Dutch translation in the same week as it came out in the UK. And Lean and I did a interview on a sort of evening talk show, and it ended up getting very connected to kind of responses to far-right politics in the Netherlands at the moment. And it sold out the next day and has had a lot of very positive press coverage in the Netherlands. You know, I think there's a readiness to kind of confront what happened in the Netherlands now. So I've had a lot of personal responses from people in Holland as well.
Because it's not just the Van Esses we hear about. We hear other tales of the resistance, like the farmer who cut off his own finger.
Yeah, Harman Bokma. I mean, it's this, he just visualises in front of you. He was presented with a three-year-old Jewish girl to hide, and he was a man who had already a milk round, and he worked in a mine. He was trying to keep his little sort of subsistence farm going, and he realized he just wouldn't be able to do that without getting paid leave to construct a hiding place within the farm, and he just decided the only way he could do that was to cut off his finger and get paid leave from the mine, and he actually did that. And you know, you just see that in front of you. You have to be full of admiration for these people who actually got really no recognition at all at the end of the war.
Also, it's hard to say no recognition, but there was also collaborators who got away scot-free.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I suppose that is a similar kind of no recognition. I spent a lot of time in the archives looking particularly at the career of a policeman in Dordrecht called Harry Avers, who very, very nearly caught Lien, the subject of my book. I mean, he was inches away from her. And at the end of the war, he claimed he'd been part of the resistance and kept up that facade for a very long time. But he was eventually convicted, and having been responsible for the death of 300 Jews in Dordrecht, he received a 3.5-year prison sentence.
Now, it's a story full of revelations. What one came as the biggest surprise?
Well, for me, as I was living it, the moment in the middle of the book where I returned to the village where my mother grew up, which is really the one village in the Netherlands that I know really well, this little place called Bennekom. And, you know, my family have always lived there on my mother's side. The story is fundamentally about my father's side of the family who lived in Dordrecht. But I went to the house in, strangely, Lien went into hiding in this little village that was my mother's village, which was already utterly surprising to me. But then I went to knock on the door of the house where she hid, which is what I did, for all the addresses that she could remember. And I went and knocked there, and the woman there said, "Oh yes, was that at the time of Mrs. Van Laar?" And I said, "Yes, it was." And she said, and I said, "You know, do you have a personal connection with her?" And she said, "No, but we found a diary of hers when we extended the cellar." And suddenly this sort of trap door opened, and I was in this world. And then she said, "Oh, you must speak to my neighbor, because he was born straight after the war." And what basically happened is that over the course of about an hour, I suddenly found this immense resistance network operating in Bennekom, which nobody had known about in my family, even though they lived in this tiny village. And that network saved 150 Jews.
Now, we've got to be careful about what we say, so not to give it a spoiler, but was it difficult balancing loyalty to your family with the discoveries that you were making?
Yes. I mean, very early on, I made a commitment to write an honest book. So I was determined to write whatever I found out, but that definitely caused anxiety for my parents. You know, it was my father's family, and there had been this terrible row with Lien, and clearly things had escalated, and you know, they did things wrong. So as I wrote those portions of the book, yeah, I felt very conflicted and worried that, you know, maybe people would end up seizing on those details of the book and being judgmental in a simplistic way. So there were definitely moments of anxiety all the way through, but I'm really pleased that actually in the round people have seen it as a human story and have actually expressed nothing but admiration for what my grandparents did.
Now, you did mention that Lien was at the Costa ceremony with you. What was her reaction to the win?
Well, she said she was utterly surprised, and she said, "I thought the young lady would win," meaning Sally Rooney. And she's always a good kind of neutral point of view on in relation to the book. She'll sometimes say, "Well, you know, it's a good book." That's the high praise she'll give it. But I think she was also really delighted. I mean, that was utterly heartfelt, our embrace that we had on stage. You know, she's not somebody dependent on getting recognition fundamentally. The way that she is now is just the result of the counselling she's gone through in the personal journey. But I think it is important to her that the book's been so successful now and is getting her story, you know, widely read around the world. So she's happy, yeah.
The book is illustrated with excerpts from our Posey diary, and there's also pictures from the war years as well. It's a very visual book, but as we're at R&IB, we're concentrating on the audio version. How did some of that translate to audio?
Yeah, that's interesting. Man, I did the audio book myself, and you know, spent sort of 3 days off and on in the studio doing that. Luckily, I do describe the photographs as they appear, so I don't think you lose too much. I mean, they are there partly just to remind people that this is all real. You know, it's so easy to think that this is, you know, it's so far in the past that it becomes the time of legend. But, I mean, sometimes I am putting documents in there that are also part of the text, like this, you know, utterly harrowing letter that Lean's mother wrote in August 1942. She didn't know who would read it, but it just says, you know, most honored sir and madam, I write to you as, you know, the mother of a daughter who is going to be lost to us. We hope that she'll survive with you. So you have that in the audio, and then in the actual book itself, you also see the little picture of that letter written in this sort of beautiful sloping hand. But I do describe the sloping hand, so I think you will not miss out too much.
Now, the Costa Book Award comes with a quite a big cheque, and I believe there's a family holiday coming up.
Yes, well, it has really been such a family project, the book. I mean, my kids, my wife, Anne-Marie, you know, have been part of the book all the way through. I've read chapters to them as I completed them. There are bits of the book where I actually reflect on our own family stresses at times. You know, I have she's technically a stepdaughter, I never call her that, my daughter Josie, who, you know, at one point in her life felt quite cut out from the family in the way that Lean felt cut out. So we're all going to go to Portugal, and I think, you know, we will feel very comfortable in ordering the sangria or whatever with Costa check in the bank.
Well, congratulations from everyone here at Read On, and thank you so much once again for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Cutout Girl, a story of war and family, lost and found, is available in print, ebook, and audio, and will be coming to the RNIB library soon. Congratulations again to Bart Van Ness. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Janice Galloway on her short story collection, Jellyfish. N.B. Dixon recommends a hidden gem from the library. And Angus MacDonald discusses his First World War story, Ardnish Was Home. But first, Juliet Stevenson is a star of stage, screen and audio. Her roll call of stage plays and audiobooks includes some of the best-known works in English literature. Not that she's let it go to her head. Despite all these calls on her time, particularly to record commercial audiobooks, she's still a regular at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And being truly, madly and deeply a fan, I just had to ask her into the studio for a chat. Juliet Stevenson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you tell me what you're recording for us at the moment?
Yes, I'm recording a novel by Antonia Byatt, otherwise known as A.S. Byatt, called The Children's Book, which I mistakenly thought was going to be a children's book. And I thought, why is it going to take 9.5 days in a studio? No child would read a book that long. But it turns out that's just the title. It's an adult novel written a few years ago, something like 2009, I think. Huge, rambling piece set at the end of the 19th century. Amazing story. But we're only on day two, so, you know, we've got a long way to go.
How much stamina, in comparison to your stage work, does it take to take on a large novel like that?
Well, I really love recording large novels. I just love the whole thing of going into a booth at 9:30 or 10 in the morning and staying there all the working day with this work of literature. It's kind of heaven for me. If the book's good, if it's not a good book, then it's a slightly different story. But most of what I'm really lucky to be asked to do are great books. So it's delicious for me to sit and do that. I mean, yeah, there's a certain point mid-afternoon where your tongue starts to feel like it's 6 foot wide and you can get a bit squinty. But I really do love it. And I love the immersion. I think what I love in all forms of work is just the immersion right down into it. And with a audiobook, that's what you're doing. You're sinking down into this book. You have to play all the characters. You get right inside the story, the novel, the observations, the thinking, the world of the fiction. And I kind of love that about it. And also, I'm not that well read. I didn't go to university and so on. So I am very grateful to the audiobook world for allowing me, giving me the chance and paying me to read some of the world's great literature.
And do you do huge amounts of preparation, marking up in different coloured pens the different characters?
I don't mark up, partly because I read off a screen these days and I can't be bothered to work those apps which you write on your screen. But yeah, I read ahead. I don't always read the whole novel before I start. I mean, ideally I would, but with huge novels, I don't always have time. So I would always read ahead of where I'm going to record. What I do is I make notes about each character. So I'll write down notes on every single person who speaks, what the author says about them, age, class, where they come from, think about what accent they might have, if any, to do with class and region, the age, obviously, so where you pitch it, and then what kind of rhythm. I'm very preoccupied by rhythms, and everybody has their own. Some people speak very fast, they think fast but speak slowly, or they think slowly and speak fast, or they speak slowly but are very powerful, or, you know, there's loads of things with rhythm that you can do. So those are the sorts of questions I will think about and make notes on. And if, as is the case with this A.S. Byatt book, you've got loads of different characters having conversations between 6, 7, 8 people in one scene, then I might cast it in my head. Because you can't really jump constantly to your notes and be reading notes every time somebody speaks. So if you cast it, so it might be, I think this character sounds like Theresa May, or sounds like David Attenborough, or sounds like the postman who comes around our house. Whoever it is, if you have somebody in your head who you think really sounds like this character, then it's a quick, easy way to jump from one to the other.
That must be where your experience of working in the theatre and working in film must come in invaluable, because you can be a director. You have worked with some amazing directors in your time and you can emulate them.
Yes, it's true. You are self-directing a lot of the time. I mean, you know, you've got a producer or a very skilled engineer the other side of the glass who's also got views on this, but I would expect for myself to make most of the decisions, and then they'll let you know if they don't like it. Or the other big consideration, perhaps the most important one for me, is what is the tone of this particular writer's voice? I don't like audiobooks where the reader is getting in the way. I love listening to them, and my kids, all the family, does do that, and we love it. But I'm always happiest when the reader is not too much getting in the way of the author. So in my view, your job is also to establish what kind of tone is this person writing in. Nick Hornby, Jane Austen, you know, Kazuo Ichiguro, or I don't know, Ali Smith. I mean, they've all got very, very different tones, and it's partly your job to find out how does this writer sound, and then serve her or him, and keep yourself a bit out of the way.
You mentioned Jane Austen, and obviously the A.S. Byatt book is another period piece. Do you enjoy historical fiction or period pieces more than any other type of fiction, or do you just get given more of those books than anything else nowadays?
I don't necessarily enjoy them more. I mean, I love reading contemporary fiction, and I'm always delighted to have a brand new book that's hot off the press, because a lot of what I love to do in the theatre and in screen is to speak to now. I mean, that's really what I want to do, is tell stories about how we are now, where are we in our world, our current world, and how do I speak to that, and how do we collectively speak to it. So that's my sort of great passion, I suppose. So I'm very happy to do new books, but it just so happens I have been asked to do a lot of classics. So yeah, I've done all of Jane Austen twice over, at least, for different publishers. I've done a lot of George Eliot, which was fantastic. I've done a lot of Brontes, and quite often you get to the sort of the less known works. I've done almost all of Virginia Woolf. Yes, there's been a lot of that. But I've also done quite a lot of contemporary stuff.
Yes, you did a fantastic Barbara Vine, The Brimstone Wedding, a few years ago, which was a terrific book.
Yeah.
And some Rose Tremaine as well, I see, as
well. Oh, that was an amazing, called Trespass. Amazing book. I loved doing that. I was completely riveted. That's one I hadn't finished reading when I started, so it partly kept me on my toes as I was reading. Yeah, I loved her.
And you had us all on the edge of our seats a couple of years ago as you were reading each new chapter of Julian Fellowes's Belgravia on a weekly basis.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Yes, that was fun. That was a fun one because that was obviously set in a period of history. And that's a great challenge because I don't think people did sound exactly like us. I mean, you don't want to put on silly voices. You don't want to distance the listener from the book. At the same time, I think it's always important to have a sense of how people might have spoken at different periods of history and not to contemporize everything. So yeah, that was really good fun, that one.
Now, that's the book that you read all by yourself. I noticed that some of the books in the RNIB library, you've read with a cast of two or three other narrators. That seems to be becoming a little bit more common. Is that something that you enjoy doing, or would you prefer to read the entire book yourself?
I'm very happy to do it. It's a bit odd because you don't meet the other reader normally, and they either have already recorded and you're coming in after, or the other way around. And so there's no collective decision about how you're going to read it and what the tone of that author is, as I just talked about. I probably would rather read the whole thing myself because I'm, you know, a bit of a junkie for this and a bit of a workaholic. So I'm so happy to immerse in the whole book. But there are times when a book really requires a male voice and a female voice or different kinds of voice or whatever. So it's an interesting development. And I think it may be lovely for the reader to have more than one, just me droning on hour after hour, but to have a sense of readers coming and going. But yeah, it's not as satisfying in the end because you haven't read the whole thing.
And of course, the other ensemble cast talking books that we have are some of the radio plays that you've recorded. I'm thinking particularly of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd that you recorded for our 80th anniversary.
Ah, yeah. Now, those are really good fun. Yeah, those are great. But that's a really different experience. That's more like, well, it's just, yeah, it's a radio play. It's a very different experience. But they're really good fun. And I also did not long ago a version of Mary Poppins, a dramatised version of the original book, which is much darker and stranger than the Mary Poppins film, the original film. So, yeah, they can be great fun, but they're not quite as immersive as reading an entire book.
And I can't let you go without mentioning The Very Hungry Caterpillar. That sounds like it was terrific fun to record, and you did that with the poet Roger McGough.
Yes, I did. Well, my kids had all read that endlessly. You know, we've got copies at home which are sort of chewed and spattered with, you know, orange juice and God knows what, the record of their childhoods, and very moth-eaten book, much loved. So, yeah, it was lovely to be asked to do that. I do love reading children's literature. I read to both my kids a lot. And my son I read to until he was about 14, 15, actually. So that takes us through a lot of literature and, yeah, it's a particular pleasure reading for children.
So if I could offer you any book in the library to record, what would be the book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get hold of?
Oh, what a great question. Well, I desperately wanted to read the Harry Potter books because I'd read four or five of them to my daughter at the time and I got completely immersed and I had voices for all those characters. I was particularly proud of my Hagrid and my Dobby the elf, and so I was absolutely furious with Stephen Fry when he was chosen to record them. So if they ever wanted to re-record them with a female voice, because it is a female author, then I would like to put myself forward, please, to be thought about. I would adore to do those books.
Well, let's hope that J.K. Rowling is listening to this programme, and I look forward to seeing plenty more of you if you do come back and record those seven whopping great books. Juliet Stevenson, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour to be a guest on Read On.
It's a great pleasure.
The past, as we have been told so many times, is a foreign country where things are done differently. This may be true, indeed it patently is true, when it comes to morals or customs, the role of women, aristocratic government, and a million other elements of our daily lives. But there are similarities, too. Ambition, envy, rage, greed, kindness, selflessness, and above all, love, have always been as powerful in motivating choices as they are today. This is a story of people who lived two centuries ago. And yet much of what they desired, much of what they resented, and the passions raging in their hearts
were only too like the dramas being played out in our own ways, in our own time.
Juliet Stevenson narrating Belgravia by Julian Fellowes, which is TB23163. For a full list of books narrated by Juliet Stevenson, go to the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And Juliet will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. When new technology was introduced for Talking Books listeners, it wasn't without its dangers.
The machines we had were very big, very cumbersome, not quite as big as the gramophone record players we had before. Some of your listeners might remember the old record players the headmaster used to have on his desk at school, the light oak machines that we used to have, made by a company called Clark & Smith in those days. Very big, very heavy, but not quite as big and heavy as the old disc players. Inside that cassette were two reels of tape, and it was a continuous loop, if you like. It went from one reel to the other and just carried on going on and on going on. At the front of that cassette, there was a big hole about an inch wide, and in that there was this large metal spring that people had to push their fingers into to change tracks. Something that you'd never be allowed to do nowadays because it's very sharp and quite dangerous.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, a royal revolt in medieval England and a story of love and blindness in the First World War. But first, Janice Galloway is an award-winning author of prose and poetry, both as fiction and non-fiction. She's also a great supporter of the RNIB and has narrated three of her books for us, most recently Jellyfish, a collection of her short stories. Robert Kirkwood caught up with her during a break in recording.
I'm with Janice Galloway in the RNIB Talking Books Studios in Glasgow. Now, the first time we met, you were recording Clara, and then it was, well, that was quite a while ago now.
That's a long while ago. Goodness me, I'm terrible at numbers, so I can't do the dates, but let's just say a while.
Then you were reading This Is Not About Me, mm-hmm. and you followed that up with All Made Up. Mm-hmm. Now, you call them anti-memoirs. Mm-hmm. Why?
Oh, because I'm twisted, basically. Because they appear to be like memoirs, but I always think the very word memoir is quite off-putting to most people because it sounds as though you're a retired colonel who's taken the horse and hounds out every weekend kind of thing and done that sort of thing. It's somehow, I don't know, maybe it's just its simple Frenchness, I think, makes it sound quite rather more sophisticated than what I was writing. Mm-hmm. And what I was writing was just about memories that I have of being young, growing up. And it was also called This Is Not About Me because basically the story of my childhood wasn't about me. It was about trying to figure out what on earth was wrong with my sister and how my mother stood it. And it wasn't all that much about me in my eyes at the time. Mm. But it's up to the reader to work out whether that makes any sense.
In your two memoirs, you were being reared by your mother, and Jellyfish is about child rearing. Do you think there's a connection?
I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I have a son who is now 26, And we'll soon be 27. This is terrifying. How did that happen? Nobody knows. And I had been writing stories about him as a wee thing, and then about his friends, and then just about the idea of children in general. So it was almost like a stockpile, and I hadn't cottoned onto, cleverly, the way you have. I wasn't able to cotton onto the fact that there might be a link between the previous books and this one. And obviously there is, because it's about real people that I really did meet and really do know by and large. But the thing about writing fiction is that you change reality in order to make it digestible for a reader or interesting for the reader. If everybody wrote down everything factual, a lot of books would be a lot more dull. So it's about paring out the bits that have nothing to do with very much and trying to lead to potential conclusions on some cases. And then the fun of meeting readers after you've done that is finding out the totally different conclusions they've reached all by themselves.
Do you find the short story form better for that, sort of making these incidents quite concise?
Well, yes, and it has that. I like writing short stories. I'm a fan of the short story form. And in my eyes, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be more popular than it used to be, that the short story form is ideal for today. Because if you've got a set of headphones, as indeed you have now, if you've got a set of headphones and you get on the train to go to work, you can listen to a whole short story without the annoyance of, I've arrived at my destination and I've just reached an exciting bit. There's something about the short story that to me is very now and is very commuter-oriented. And since I commute a lot, since my son, who now lives in London, commutes a lot, I think that kind of reader is the kind of reader that I had that I've always had in mind somehow, the person who has less time to read than they might like.
In America, the short story is really revered. Do you think it's because of publications like The New Yorker who publish short stories and we don't have something like that?
Well, it's because some very famous writers have written short stories in the States. And there is a general assumption, not in Europe, it's in Britain in particular, that if you write short stories, you can't be up to much. What we want is a big fat book, thank you very much. The last thing I ever want is a big fat book. I mean, War and Peace is wonderful, but my God, you know, you have to be retired to actually take up reading it. So I can do it now. But I think an awful lot of people, the world is in a state of intense movement at the moment. And thank God for that. The alternative is that it slows down. Now, what's going to happen? I'm sorry to mention the Brexit word, but what's going to happen to us? I have no idea. But to me, it just seems logical to write shorter stories, almost as a kind of refuge for people who don't have much time to read, but would love to read us something. And those are there. And I like writing them. They give you much more reward than writing a novel in some ways, because you have to reach a conclusion in a short time. And then you need to think of something else that reaches a conclusion in a short time. And there's a spontaneity and a fun in doing that that you don't get with a novel.
And I know you're a fan of poetry. Do you think there's a fine line between the short story and the poem?
Shortness in itself suggests a bond. People who like to express themselves in fewer words will tend to appear to have a bond, but actually poetry is a whole different ballgame in so many ways. Contemporary poetry can read like prose, and contemporary prose can read like poetry. I think we're in an age where those kind of boxes that you were meant to categorise a book inside are fading for, what should we call, the career writers. Now, that doesn't mean to say that it's fading for people who stock books and sell them in shops. They still want to call the book a something. I would seriously urge people who are fond of books in general to look beyond what you can find in a shop, look online at a place that will be stocking more esoteric books and see what else you might be missing, because there's a whole field that doesn't fall into any category now that is well worth reading and getting used to.
I know music was very important to Clara, and there are a couple of stories in Jellyfish which again have that connection to music.
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of music baby. I have liked music from I was small. My mother always sang. I had a team of aunties who sang at weddings, usually. The Giza song at the wedding thing was one I'm entirely familiar with. And it was expected, because I started to study music at school. I had a wonderful music teacher called Ken Hetherington. And he kind of showed me that music wasn't an exclusive thing at all. Whatever kind of music you like is legitimate. Now, that still seems to be problematic. I sometimes visit schools and you'll still find kids who think anything called classical music has to belong to another kind of person. Of course it doesn't. The people who wrote it were as skint as anybody. The people who played it were as skint as anybody. It's a kind of music that one time a class of people could seem to own, but now we can all have it very easily. We can all have anything these days very easily.
Now, is it important that your work is being translated into audio?
Yeah, sure it is, because people are in a rush. I mean, one of the things I think about is the commuter. This is how I get about. I get about in trains and buses, usually trains, but buses if I fancy the journey. And yes, I think people, that's the only chance some people get to read a book, because you can be kind of by yourself in a midst of people.
And obviously we're in RNIB's building as well. Some people don't have the choice as well. So it's a way of making your literature accessible to everyone.
Yeah, this has always been, I have been coming to RNIB for a long time, and it's always such a pleasure to do so, because, you know, there's a section of an audience, there's a section of people who are very keen to hear these things, and it's sometimes much more difficult to get hold of things to listen to. And it's always been an exciting thing to do, to come here.
Janice Galloway, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Gold. Blister cushions, small flashlight, signal mirror, compass. She should write it down. A note, a message, something clear and clean. He would want to know. The first time it appeared, she understood what had happened, but didn't know what to think. By the second and third, the pattern was clear, but waiting even a little longer would show she had been contained enough to offer some kind of testimony, and by the fifth day, she was ready. After the morning's now usual ritual, she sat up inside the sleeping bag, folded the pillow, and reached for the notebook Charlie had given her, still clean inside its plastic case, the pen still loaded with ink. All she had to do was open a fresh page, then write it out in simple language. One careful letter at a time. Every morning now for close on 5 days, the sun comes to meet me. It filters through the roof vent in a single shaft of light and turns my hands to gold.
Thanks to Robert and Janice Galloway. Jellyfish, a short book of short stories, is TB703469. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, Angus MacDonald on One Blind Soldier's Long Journey Home from Gallipoli and the books of Juliet Stevenson's life. But before that, here at Read On, we like nothing better than to hear about the books that you're enjoying. So, if you've just finished a book that you'd like us to feature, or found a hidden gem in the RNIB library, why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And that's just what author and regular contributor N.B. Dixon did. Here's her latest review.
Hello, this is N.B. Dixon, and here is my review of the audiobook Shields of Pride by Elizabeth Chadwick. It's available from both Audible and the RNIB Talking Books Library, and in both cases is brilliantly read by Jonathan Oliver.
Dismounting, Jocelyn tossed his reins to his own squire and approached the crippled Wayne. The soldiers stiffened, hands descending to sword hilts and fingers tightening upon spear shafts. The noble, who had turned round at the first sound of horses on the road, narrowed his eyes as he recognised Jocelyn. Jocelyn regarded him with similar disfavour. Giles de Montsorel was a young baron, distantly related to the Earl of Leicester, and thus considered himself high nobility. He viewed Jocelyn, the mere bastard of a warrior who had carved his own nobility by the sword, as dung beneath his boots. They had encountered each other occasionally on the French tourney circuits, but no amity had sprung from these meetings. Montsorel was not a man to forgive being bowled from the saddle on the blunt end of a jousting lance.
Shields of Pride is a fantastic historical novel. It's the story of Jocelyn, who is the illegitimate son of William Ironheart. Because of his illegitimacy, he's unable to inherit any of his father's lands, so he's forced to make his own way in the world. His half-brother, Ragnar, William Ironheart's legitimate heir, is jealous of his father's favouritism of his half-brother. Gradually, his jealousy consumes him until it proves the downfall for the entire family.
Forced by circumstance to be civil, Montsorel gave Jocelyn the iciest of nods. His lips tight as a drawn purse, dusky colour seeping into his face. Jocelyn returned the nod in the same spirit and turned his attention to the broken cartwheel. Not just broken, he could see now, but hopelessly shattered, where an ill-fitting iron tire had pulled the frame out of true. "You haven't a hope in hell of cobbling that mess back together," he said impatiently. "You'll have to hire a cart from the nearest village. Clerkenwell isn't far." He walked slowly around the stricken carcass of the wain, examining it thoughtfully from all angles, before halting in front of the three sturdy cobs, still harnessed in line between the shafts. "How much weight do you carry?" "None of your business."
This is a story of betrayal and loyalty and heartbreak, and it's very easy to read as well. Elizabeth Chadwick is one of my favourite historical fiction writers. In fact, I would go so far as to say that she is one of my influences. And part of that reason is because she's just a great storyteller. Her books are very easy to read. You get into them very quickly. You're carried along by her descriptions of the medieval English culture and society and settings. And you can tell that she just absolutely loves what she's writing about and that she's poured an awful lot of research into what she writes. Shields of Pride was the first book of hers that I ever read, and until recently it was actually my favourite of hers. It's just been topped, but it will always be one of my favourite books, and I wanted to be able to share it with other listeners.
Shields of Pride, written by Elizabeth Chadwick and narrated by Jonathan Oliver, is TB14619. Thanks as always to N.B. Dixon. Her new novel, Earl of Huntingdon, is out now, bringing her Outlaw's Legacy series to a thrilling conclusion. Now, before we return to Juliet Stevenson to share the books of her life, Angus MacDonald's novel Ardnish Was Home was a labour of love that took 16 years to write, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
"I'm Angus MacDonald. I'm the author of Ardnish Was Home, and it's about a boy growing up in the West Highlands in a very remote community. And it tells the stories of life of making hay and making illegal whiskey and stalking a deer and gathering of the sheep. And anyway, our hero, who's 20 years old, goes off to fight in Gallipoli in the First World War in the Lovett Scouts. And on his train on the way south, he meets a girl. And anyway, he arrives in Gallipoli, and who should the girl be? But when he gets badly injured, the girl reappears as the nurse. And then they retreat through Bulgaria and Greece and back to Malta. And he is telling her his life growing up. And she, Louise, is also talking about the coal mining area of South Wales. So that is the story. There's a big twist right at the end of it. But basically it's a romantic Highland historical novel.
And the injury the soldier suffers is sight loss. Does that continue right the way through the book?
Yeah, so he's captured by the Turks and he's tortured and he loses complete eyesight for the first 2 weeks, and then one of his eyesight comes back to a very limited way, and the way he does his travelling is on a donkey, which features quite a major way. Mm. That's a really interesting point, actually, because I was very concerned about would it actually be possible for somebody to retreat for several hundred miles through enemy country when he couldn't see? He was also very badly injured in his shoulder, so he was very, very weak. But using a stick and working with the nurse and then the donkey is really how he managed to move around.
And tell us about your other work, because you're not only a novelist.
I left school at 17, so I didn't finish school. I then was incredibly lucky. A, I got into the army. B, as an officer, left the army, and I managed to wangle my job, a job in finance, investment management, and I loved that. And then I started a financial publishing company, and that did incredibly well. Now I've sold that to the Wall Street Journal. I have a number of other businesses in recycling and renewable energy and education.
And you're quite philanthropic in the way you're trying to boost business in the Highlands.
Yes. So I put 10% of what I make into a charitable trust, and it's all about stimulating the economy of the West Highlands to help people to build businesses, which will in turn sustain the communities where the people are from.
But you're still going to write a sequel to this novel as well?
Well, on the basis this one took 16 years, I'm not going to base my pension on it. But I'm very pleased by how well this one's been received. So I'm going to fast forward on the novel.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and Angus MacDonald, Ardnish Was Home, a novel, is available commercially in paperback and ebook.
And also available in print and ebook is the sequel that we talked about. It's called We Fought for Ardnish.
Now it's back to Juliet Stevenson to hear the books of her life. So, Juliet, was there a book that you read as a child or a very young woman that made you fall in love with reading?
I don't remember a moment when I fell in love with reading, because I just don't remember when that started, because they were always in my life. I mean, I was quite a solitary kid because I was an army child and my older brothers were away at school a lot of the time. And when you move on all the time in the army, you lose your friends every time you move country. And I did move from continent, you know, literally from Australia to Germany to Malta to like that. So you're often on your own quite a lot. So reading is a big, big factor in my childhood. And I mean, I remember so many, but I vividly remember reading The Famous Five. And I know they're not considered really great literature. And certainly when you read them now to kids, you think, whoa, this is not great writing. But I love The Famous Five. And I heavily identified with George, with Georgina. I was a bit of a boyish girl in some ways, in the sense that I loved running around and getting dirty and climbing trees, and I didn't like dolls and learning to sew and all those stupid traditional gender stereotypical things that in my childhood kids were pushed towards. So I think I really identified with Georgina, and I think that's quite a big thing actually when I look back, because there weren't hardly any role models for young girls other than those very sort of classic cliches. So The Famous Five was a big one for me, and I read all of them. I remember also getting very, very immersed and obsessed with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, the Narnia books, C.S. Lewis, which I have a different feeling about now. I'm not sure. Coming back to them, reading to my children, I think, oh, really? But I love them as a child.
Anne was trying to do some of her prep in a corner of the common room when her cousin George came bursting in. George was not a boy. She was a girl called Georgina. But because she had always wanted to be a boy, she insisted on being called George. So, George she was. She wore her curly hair cut short, and her bright blue eyes gleamed angrily now as she came towards Anne. Anne, I've just had a letter from home, and what do you think? Father wants to go and live on my island to do some special work. And he wants to build a sort of tower or something in the castle yard. The other girls looked up in amusement. And Anne held out her hand for the letter that George was waving at her. Everyone knew about the little island off Kirin Bay that belonged to George. Kirin Island was a tiny place with an old ruined castle in the middle of it. the home of rabbits and gulls and jackdaws. It had underground dungeons, in which George and her cousins had had one or two amazing adventures.
The RNIB Library has a huge range of Enid Blyton books in a full range of accessible formats, including Five on Kirin Island Again, narrated by Jan Francis, which is TB11876. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, that's a tricky one. I don't tend to reread because I'm still chasing the books I haven't yet read the first time. But if I had to choose to reread something, it would probably have to be Middlemarch, George Eliot, which I think is such a genius novel and so rich and so detailed that it probably requires at least two readings even to get anywhere near the bottom of it. It's like this phenomenal tapestry, isn't it? And yeah, I'd love to reread that if I had the time.
The pride of being ladies had something to do with it. The Brooke connections, though not exactly aristocratic, were unquestionably good. If you inquired backward for a generation or two, you would not find any yard-measuring or parcel-tying forefathers, anything lower than an admiral or a clergyman. And there was even an ancestor discernible as a Puritan gentleman who served under Cromwell, but afterwards conformed and managed to come out of all political troubles as the proprietor of a respectable family estate. Young women of such birth, living in a quiet country house and attending a village church hardly larger than a parlour, naturally regarded frippery as the ambition of a huckster's daughter. Then there was well-bred economy, which in those days made show in dress the first item to be deducted from, when any margin was required for expenses more distinctive of rank.
Helen Bourne narrating Middlemarch by George Eliot, which is TB19194. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, you know, I'm always very behind the rest of the world, so I only very recently read Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. I know it's not a new novel, but I rarely get the chance to read things hot off the press, but I really, really loved it. And I think he has the most astonishing capacity to really, a bit like an actor, like a really supreme actor, he has the capacity to go deeply inside characters, different, separate characters. He can do that and imagine what it's like to be them. And therefore, he has them speak and function and interact with each other in a way that has complete human integrity and imagination. And I think it's so interesting what it's tackling, because it's an imaginary world where science has brought us to the place where human organs are so badly needed that a whole species of people are being bred simply as sort of organ farms. So at a certain point in their young adulthood, they have their organs extracted, and then, you know, after two or three of those operations, they, of course, die. And they've been bred quite separately to the rest of the world for that purpose. But that, of course, you don't know until well into the novel. Oh, I hope I haven't spoiled it. And I think it raises fantastically interesting questions about science's relationship to the mystery of life and the value and the sort of sacred value of each human life. This is not the moment to go into all those questions. They're many and they're complex. But I think as you look at a world which is on a daily basis deciding that some lives are more valuable than others, for example, the lives of refugees drowning in the Mediterranean don't appear to matter to anybody enough to record their deaths, whereas white privileged lives in the West, the loss of one of those lives is recorded and rightly grieved. But we're living in a world where really lives have different values, and that is a travesty, really, in terms of the way we should all live together on the planet. So I think he is actually inadvertently perhaps tackling something of great importance.
My name is Kathy H.
I'm 31 years old, and I've been a carer now for over 11 years. That sounds long enough, I know, but actually they want me to go on for another 8 months until the end of this year. That'll make it almost exactly 12 years. Now, I know my being a carer so long isn't necessarily because they think I'm fantastic at what I do. There are some really good carers who have been told to stop after just 2 or 3 years. And I can think of one carer at least who went on for all of 14 years despite being a complete waste of space. So, I'm not trying to boast. But then, I do know for a fact they've been pleased with my work. And by and large, I have too. My donors have always tended to do much better than expected. Their recovery times have been impressive, and hardly any of them have been classified as agitated, even before fourth donation. Okay, maybe I am boasting now. But it means a lot to me, being able to do my work well. Especially that bit about my donors staying calm. I've developed a kind of instinct around donors. I know when to hang around and comfort them, when to leave them to themselves, when to listen to everything they have to say and when just to shrug and tell them to snap out of it.
Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro is available in Braille, giant print and as TB14158, narrated by Rachel Atkins. Juliet Stevenson, thank you so much for not only sharing your love of reading, but also for bringing to life so many books for us as Talking Books.
It's a real pleasure. It's a job I love doing, so thanks for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.